Top stories this hour. South Korea says the North is preparing for a nuclear test, with the U.S. warning it could happen during President Biden's visit to South or to Seoul this week. The military wing of Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement declares its readiness to confront the Israeli regime in all territories. And the UN Secretary General warns about years of mass hunger and famine as the war in Ukraine worsens a global food crisis. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. A South Korean lawmaker warns that North Korea is ready to conduct a nuclear test at any moment. Following a briefing by the National Intelligence Service, the lawmaker talked about the completion of Pyongyang's preparations for a nuclear test, adding they're only looking for the right time. Meanwhile, the United States has warned that a possible nuclear test could happen while President Joe Biden is in Seoul this week. This is going to be Biden's first trip as president to Asia. And the U.S. intelligence says it's possible that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would stage a provocation after Biden arrives in Seoul late Friday. The U.S. and North Korea have been locked in a standoff over Pyongyang's missile and nuclear tests, which the White House describes as provocative. But the North argues it needs them to protect itself from America. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, says its forces are ready for confrontation with the Israeli regime. The resistance group says it's prepared for a war with Tel Aviv in the Gaza Strip, Jenin, or other parts of the occupied territories. It has pledged to continue resistance until the liberation of all Palestinian land. According to Quds Brigades, resistance has grown stronger and more equipped in the past year, and is ready to repel any Israeli attack. Israeli forces have in recent months escalated their raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as the occupied West Bank. The atrocities have led to widespread protests. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement has hailed the results of the country's parliamentary elections as a great victory for the resistance front. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says the gains of Hezbollah and its allies in the elections show the people support the resistance and want it to keep its weapons. He also praised the Lebanese people for their massive participation in the electoral process, despite all the economic, social, and political upheavals in the country. Nasrallah said the voters' enthusiasm and turnout showed they didn't care about 3 years of media campaign to boycott the vote. Hezbollah and its allies have won 62 seats in the 128-member assembly. 13 seats have also gone to independent candidates who have yet to choose a bloc. For the first time, Russia has fired missiles from its S-300 defense systems in Syria to target Israeli warplanes. This may signal a shift in Russia's relationship with Israel when it comes to Syria and by default towards Iran's interests in Syria. The real question now is whether Israel is going to continue bombing Syria even though it risks getting hit by Russian missiles.
Tensions between Russia and Israel appear to be on the rise. Israeli media reports say Russian forces have opened fire on Israeli jets with advanced S-300 anti-aircraft missiles. The missiles were fired at Israeli warplanes after they attacked targets in northwestern Syria. The move is seen as a sign of significant shift in Moscow's attitude toward Israel. The unprecedented incident is said to have occurred on Friday night when Israeli jets targeted an area near the city of Masyaf, which killed several people. Israel's airstrikes on targets in Syria are countered by the country's anti-aircraft missile batteries. But this time, however, the S-300 batteries also opened fire as the jets were departing the area.
It is the case that these missiles, the S-300 battery, is operated by Russian military personnel, and that they would not have fired without permission from senior commanders. Okay, This is a break in the normal procedure.
Syria's S-300 batteries are operated by Russian military and cannot be fired without their approval. Israeli media reports claim the S-300 radar did not manage to lock onto the Israeli jets and thus did not present a serious threat to the fighter jets. But this would mark the first use of the S-300s against the Israeli warplanes over Syria. It's not clear whether the S-300 missile fire was a one-time event or if it was a Russian signal to Israel that it was changing its policy.
So this was the first use of it, and it was known to be done by Russian military personnel at Russian military command. But it also, they did not lock the radar on the planes. So the planes were never in danger. It's unclear from the reports whether they couldn't lock the radar on the planes or whether they just didn't lock them. And just wanted to throw these missiles up there as a kind of signal and a warning to Israel that, you know, we may change our policy and we may take down some planes.
Israel is believed to have conducted hundreds of missile strikes on Syria. It claims that it's targeting Iranian sites and weapons meant for Hezbollah in Lebanon. But Iran is present on the Syrian soil and with the invitation of the Syrian government. Meantime, the Israeli bombardments continue to claim both civilian and military lives.
The development comes amid deteriorating relations between Tel Aviv and Moscow over Ukraine. Israel has backed Ukraine after the war began. Tel Aviv's stance has angered Russia. Russia's latest move against Israel would be a worrying development for Israel.
And that has to do, of course, with the whole reverberations of what's going on with Ukraine. And, you know, the Russians are realizing that and starting to act much more militantly in the sense that they understand this is now a war for the future of a lot of things.
The Tel Aviv regime has repeatedly targeted the positions of the Syrian army and its allies, but has rarely acknowledged or discussed such operations. The aerial bombardment intensified in scale and frequency after 2011, when the Arab country found itself in the grip of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism.
Oh, it will continue. No question about it. Look, it's not going to even think about stopping until a plane goes down. If S-300s or some other effective anti-aircraft defense takes down Israeli planes, then there'll be a problem. So the Russians have signaled something here, and they didn't take down a plane. And until and unless they do, Israel's not going to change its policy on that at all. And even if they do, that would cause a problem for Israel, and they would have to think twice about it.
Damascus says Tel Aviv carries out attacks on the Arab country to aid terrorist groups against the Syrian army. It has repeatedly complained to the United Nations, calling the aggression a blatant violation of the country's sovereignty and international law. The development comes after warmongering rhetoric of Israeli officials against Iran and its allies. Just recently, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, said Tel Aviv would prevent Iran from transferring advanced capabilities to its allies in the region. But Iran has dismissed the threat, saying it's determined to help the resistance axis stand up against Israel's aggressive moves in the region.
Just like I said before earlier in this news bulletin, the military wing of Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement has declared its readiness to confront the Israeli regime in all territories. Now, to get more information on that, I'm now joined by our correspondent in Gaza City, Ashraf Shannon. Ashraf, it's good to talk to you. So tell us more about that preparedness.
Yes, I mean, last night during a big rally to mark the victory of Palestinian resistance groups against the Israeli regime during the 11-day war back in 2021, the Islamic Jihad's military wing, Al-Quds Brigades, talked about its readiness and its preparedness to fight the Israeli regime and to deter any future attacks on Palestinians. The spokesman of the Al-Quds Brigades, Abu Hamza, reiterated the movement's readiness to launch thousands of rockets against the Israeli regime, even more than the launches that they made during 2021. During the war, Palestinian resistance groups, mainly Hamas's military wing, the Qassam Brigades, the Islamic Jihad's military wing, Al-Quds Brigades, and other Palestinian resistance factions lost at least 1,400 rockets towards the Israeli regime and caused severe damage within the military infrastructure of the Israeli regime, while the Israeli forces retaliated by attacking civilian infrastructures in Gaza, killing scores of people, mainly women and children, and attacking thousands of buildings and attacking the civilian infrastructure in Gaza. A few weeks ago, the Al-Quds Brigades also released footage of the new drones that they have developed to use in any future confrontation with the Israeli regime, Omid.
So Ashraf, how is this statement related to Ismail Haniyeh's warning that he issued, I guess before this statement, warning the Israeli regime not to go ahead with its assassination policy?
Well, all the Palestinian resistance factions have made similar statement to that of Mr. Ismail Haniyeh regarding the targeted assassination of Palestinian leaders and commanders. Even Abu Hamza, the spokesman of the Quds Brigades, talked about the possible assassinations of Palestinian leaders, and also issued a strong warning to the Israeli regime regarding this. 3 years ago, when Israeli military assassinated Baha Abu Al-Ata, one of the top military commanders of the Islamic Jihad, the Islamic Jihad just by itself fired hundreds of rockets towards the Israeli regime, almost paralyzing the Israeli regime at that time.
Thank you so much, Ashraf Shannon, for joining us this hour, our correspondent in Gaza City. Moving on. The United Nations envoy on the impacts of sanctions has wrapped up her 10-day visit to Iran. Her trip was aimed at assessing the human rights violations caused by the United States sanctions on Iran. Our correspondent, Youssef Jaloli, reports.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran, Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
The UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are legal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one, to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The UN Secretary General has warned about years of mass hunger and famine if no steps are taken to contain a global food crisis worsened by the war in Ukraine.
Russia must permit the safe and secure export of grain stored in Ukrainian ports. Alternative transportation routes can be explored, even if we know that by itself they will not be enough to solve the problem. And Russian food and fertilizers must have unrestricted access to world markets without indirect impediments. I have been in intense contact on this issue at the senior leadership level with the Russian Federation, Ukraine, Turkey, the United States, the European Union, and several other key countries. I am hopeful, but there is still a long way to go. The complex security, economic, and financial implications require goodwill on all sides for a package deal to be reached.
Antonio Guterres was addressing a food security meeting at the UN. He said the war in Ukraine is compounding global food insecurity amid warming temperatures and the coronavirus pandemic. The UN chief said the number of severely food insecure people has doubled from 135 million to 276 million in just 2 years. Guterres said the war in Ukraine threatens to tip tens of millions of people over the edge into food insecurity. The war and economic sanctions on Russia have increased global prices for food and fuel, especially in developing countries. Russia and Ukraine account for nearly a third of global wheat supplies.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Flush with cash, a PAC appears to be a heavy weight in this year's U.S. midterm elections as it goes after progressives and floods its preferred candidates with millions. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "As the midterms approach, a PAC throws its weight and money around Washington." Stay tuned for more. Last week, Representative Chantel Brown defeated Nina Turner in an Ohio Democratic primary race for the second time in 9 months. Turner had been endorsed by Progressive Squad member Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and is a vocal critic of the fabricated regime of Israel. Her loss is largely seen as a win for the Israel lobby and specifically the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. In December, AIPAC launched two political action committees, PACs, as a way to be more effective in fulfilling their mission in the current political environment, according to a statement published by the group on social media. In less than 6 months since it was established, AIPAC's PAC has delivered $6 million to hundreds of candidates, becoming the biggest pro-Israel PAC in the United States of America, while its super PAC, the United Democracy Project, UDP, has raised nearly $16 million in contributions. Since AIPAC's PAC operates as a traditional PAC, it can only spend $5,000 per candidate, but its super PAC can spend unlimited amounts of money. AIPAC said in a statement about its fundraising, "Our goal is to make America's friendship with Israel so robust, so certain, so broadly based, and so dependable that even the deep divisions of American politics can never imperil that relationship and the ability of the Jewish state to defend itself," unquote. Flush with cash, AIPAC appears to be a heavyweight in this year's U.S. midterm elections as it goes after progressives and floods its prepared and preferred candidates with millions. AIPAC congratulated Representative Brown on her election victory, writing that it's proud to stand with pro-Israel progressive leaders running against anti-Israel candidates. Endorsed by AIPAC, Brown received significant financial backing from the organization. According to campaign tracker Open Secrets, Brown received $83,171 from AIPAC Super PAC, UDP, and nearly $270,000 from its regular PAC, according to the Federal Election Commission. UDP also spent nearly $200,000 against Brown's opponent, Turner. UDP spokesman Patrick Dorton told Jewish Insider about the PAC's election season plans. "We intend to be active in a significant number of races where there is a clear difference between a candidate who supports a strong U.S.-Israel relationship and a candidate that does not or who may seek to undermine that relationship," unquote. Turner was targeted by the lobby for supporting conditioning aid to the fabricated regime of Israel and standing in solidarity with Palestine on Twitter. AIPAC has also had its hand in several other key races across the United States of America. The group had been actively involved in the Texas race between Jessica Cineros and Representative Henry Culler, as well as Pennsylvania's fight between Representative Summer Lee and Steve Irvin. According to FEC filings, AIPAC has spent over $1 million against Representative Lee and a combined total of more than $600,000 from both its PAC and Super PAC for Irvin. AIPAC's regular PAC must disclose its donor list, but the Super PAC isn't required to reveal contributors' identities. Both PAC's donors are a mix of real estate and finance moguls, but there are some notable contributors. Israeli-American media tycoon Haim Saban contributed the largest amount to UDP. with a donation of $1 million, but he isn't the only company head funneling pro-Israeli campaign contributions. The CEOs of several firms have also donated to the PACs. Ballot Flats brand Tix co-founder and CEO Kefir Gavirelli gave $5,000 to Apex PAC. The founder, CEO, and president of Tasty Brands, David Horowitz, pumped $50,000 into UDP. Jimmy Haber, CEO of BLT Restaurant Group, donated $5,000 to the regular PAC. Fernando Estiu, CEO of Mar Vista Entertainment, which was required by Fox in December, contributed $3,500 to APAC's PAC. Grant F. Smith, the director of the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, IRMEP, sees these donor disclosures as an opportunity for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement to more strategically target the fabricated regime of Israel's lobby. AIPAC has really exposed itself in the United States and provided a fairly wide-open arena for people who don't like their programs to start talking about their donors in ways that have never been possible before, Smith said. Yet with these significant political contributions comes significant political sway. Mega donor Saban has had a strong foothold in politics for decades. In 2002, he gave $13 million to the Brookings Institution to establish the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, now the Center for Middle East Policy. The center's founding director, Martin Indyk, openly supported the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Saban's money has also kept former President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in line with regard to the Zionist regime. The donations by Israel partisans have managed to keep almost every elected representative in Israel's pocket with almost no exceptions. Alison Weir, American journalist and founder of Research Institute, If Americans Knew, told Mint Press News. AIPAC's PACs aren't backed just by CEO investors, but also by the organization itself. AIPAC's own employees have channeled more than $80,000 into its regular PAC. Within that sum, AIPAC president Betsy Korn poured $10,000 into the regular PAC through her company, B-Vision Sports Media. AIPAC received widespread criticism for endorsing 109 of the 147 Republicans who voted against certifying the 2020 presidential election results following the January 6 insurrection at Capitol Hill. For Hickson, this development is telling because it underscores the growing divide among American Jews. AIPAC is becoming increasingly viewed as the Republican wing of the lobby, he said. Since its creation, a core tenet of AIPAC has been its bipartisanship, but Hickson believes AIPAC is moving farther and farther away from its original doctrine, explaining AIPAC hasn't cut off funding to Democrats who will take a pro-Israel line, but the fact that they support the far right and have identified so closely with former President Donald Trump is a significant change because it encourages these splits in a liberal Jewish so-called community. Polling suggests American Jews are becoming more critical of the fabricated regime of Israel, with a quarter considering it an apartheid regime. Democratic voters are also taking a harsher position on this regime, with a majority supporting sanctions over Israel's settlement activity and more than 40% believing the U.S. should withhold aid to the Zionist regime. A University of Maryland poll also found that fewer than 1% of Democratic respondents view the Zionist regime as the U.S. first or second most important ally. According to Smith, AIPAC has always purported to be unified voice of the American Jewish community, but that self-proclaimed title isn't true. During the joint IRMEP and American Educational Institute, Israel's Influence, Good or Bad for America, 2016 conference, Smith debunked the lobby's false narrative that Americans who are Jewish are all Israel Affinity Organization members who support lobbying from these groups. According to a 2013 Pew Research Center survey on Jewish identity, 82% of American Jews aren't members of Israel lobbying organizations. Smith accordingly asked at the conference, "So who does the lobby really represent? Well, the views and concerns of mega donors, for sure. The views and concerns of a relatively small group of boards and directors and top officials. And of course, the Israeli regime, with which many are in direct and ongoing consultation. With Jewish and Democratic voters becoming less concerned with the alliance between the United States of America and the Zionist regime, the gap between representative and constituents appears to be widening. As Weir put it, it's a contest between the elites that fund candidates and the grassroots that often want something different. So we are seeing that the elites, almost all of whom are pro-Israel, will continue giving huge amounts of money to candidates and buying a lot of candidates that way."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
U.S. sanctions severely impact human rights. That is a grim assessment by a top U.N. human rights official who has slammed the United States for its brutal sanctions regime against the Islamic Republic of Iran. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine her remarks not only about the brutal sanctions on Iran, but also its impacts on other countries and why it rarely achieves U.S. objectives, if at all.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S.? shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that it, when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are illegal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling the for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Our guest, Daniel Kovalik, he's a university lecturer and author of The Plot to Attack Iran, who joins us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Daniel Kovalik, welcome. We have this special rapporteur from the UN who I'm going to read the title, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Negative Impact of Unilateral Coercive Measures on the Enjoyment of Human Rights. Now, she's been in Iran from May 7th to the 18th, today being the 18th, and it's the first by a UN Special Rapporteur in this type of visit. And she has concluded, amongst many things, decades of sanctions have wholly affected Iranian people's lives, and a particularly hit low-income section of society. On this one finding that she announced, what is your reaction?
Well, I mean, it makes sense. I believe it. I think we've known this for a long time, those of us who've been condemning sanctions as both illegal and immoral, because, in fact, they're intended to hurt people, and they do hurt the most vulnerable. And there have been studies over the years in countries, for example, like North Korea, which have shown that these types of sanctions disproportionately hurt women and children. And again, we've known that for years, and we've known that in Venezuela. There have been reports on Venezuela as well. So this is not a surprise to me.
When you take a look at another statement she made, and I'm wondering if this would make any difference, she has said the unilateral coercive measures, as she called it, the UCM against Iran, and she works under a mandate from the UN Human Rights Council. She's called on Washington to abandon, according to what she said, its hard-nosed policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Will Washington do that or listen?
Well, I'm not certain. There was some good news this week. Biden announced that he is going to end the maximum pressure campaign against Venezuela, and he has rolled back some sanctions, extra sanctions that Trump had imposed on Cuba. So maybe there's a chance that someone in the U.S. will listen. This report, in truth, is well-timed. Maybe there's someone in the White House at the moment who will listen to this. I certainly hope so.
When it comes to the issue of sanctions themselves, of course, she has raised the legality of it, something which many have said, obviously, is illegal. And she said the U.S. continues to illegally ban trade and investment, for example, in Iran, forcing foreign companies economically for the country to take a hit by them leaving in fear of sanctions. And also the fact that, obviously, these foreign companies cannot conduct financial activities. The legality of the sanctions is something that could fall under the UN, or can it not, in terms of a mandate that's illegal, the illegality of it, and then for the UN therefore do something about it?
Yeah, well, the UN has ruled that these types of sanctions are illegal, especially to the extent they have extraterritorial application, which these do. What does that mean? It's when the U.S., for example, and the U.S. uses these types of sanctions the most. The U.S. not only says, okay, we're going to sanction Iran by not trading with Iran, for example, right? But what they do, they go well beyond that. They impose pressure and sanctions on third countries who want to do business with Iran, right? And that, the U.N. has said, is clearly illegal. Only the Security Council can authorize that those types of sanctions. And they have not done so in this case. So they're clearly illegal.
What about the fact that you have sanctions as a whole in terms of the effectiveness? Based on our accounts, we have more than 40 economic sanctions placed on 36 countries that the U.S. has exercised since 1993. But it is said that the efficiency rate of sanctions is roughly maybe between 23% to 25% at best, and it's not the kind of success rate that the U.S. actually is looking for. And it doesn't obtain the desired results that the U.S. is looking for. So why does the U.S. go down a road where basically it's a failed policy in terms of how it uses it?
Well, again, what are the goals of these sanctions? The goals tend to be regime change. They want to change the government in power. To the extent that's the goal, it almost never succeeds. In fact, you know, the U.S.'s own studies show that, right? But what it is effective in doing is undermining the country's economies, right? And so what does that do for the U.S.? I mean, that is at least a secondary goal of the U.S. If they can't destroy the government or change the government, they're going to cripple the society, right? And so it just becomes purely punitive. And that is a secondary goal. And that is the type of sanction they impose very frequently on these countries. Again, the goal seemingly only to be to punish the people for choosing the wrong government. And that sends a message to other countries, you better not choose the wrong government, right? So it has a certain effectiveness in that way. It's a cruel goal, but that is, in fact, the goal.
You mentioned Venezuela. Maybe it's good to do a flashback here back to the year 2019. I don't know if you remember, there was a report that came out, and this is right before COVID, actually, that U.S. sanctions on Venezuela is responsible for tens of thousands of deaths, based on a report that came out. And this was, of course, not the beginning, but it was almost in the middle of the U.S. push for wanting Maduro out and wanting the other opposition leader to come into power. But then, as you mentioned, the U.S. has announced that it's rolling back some of the sanctions on Venezuela, and you mentioned Cuba also. But when it has given the green light, it's for the sanctions to roll back. But isn't that for its own benefit, because it's looking for oil? As it has said, U.S. and European oil companies can restart their operations. So it's for U.S.'s benefit. It's not really looking out for Venezuelans.
No, well, again, that's never the intention. You know, the U.S. may claim it cares about people in Venezuela or Iran or Cuba or Nicaragua, but that's not true. That's never true. As you say, these things are done according to the U.S.'s own shifting interest at any given time. And as you say, at the moment, with the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia, now the U.S. finds itself in a world where oil and gas are becoming more scarce, prices are going up, so now they're looking for other sources, including from Venezuela and including from Iran, And that is motivating, as you say, fairly, the U.S. to lift some sanctions on Venezuela with the hope that Venezuela, that they can get oil again from Venezuela. And we know that they want oil from Iran, and maybe that will motivate the U.S. to lift some sanctions on Iran. But you're right. It's all for self-serving purposes. And you mentioned the study that was done by CEPR, which is a think tank in the United States. And they, according to their study, which is probably the most detailed of its kind, they estimated in 1 year alone 40,000 Venezuelans died due to U.S. sanctions. So that's an staggering number of people, given that those sanctions have continued for a number of years. So you add it up, you're looking at hundreds of thousands of deaths. And I'm sure that you could find the same numbers in Iran.
Well, one of the open admissions could not be any clearly spelled out when it came from the former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I don't know if you remember that. He said that if Iranian officials must listen to Washington if they want their people to eat. That was a pretty profoundly shocking statement coming from a U.S. official. It's an open threat to starve the Iranian nation, which at that point the former foreign minister of Iran said is a crime against humanity and a desperate attempt to impose U.S. whims on Iran. What's your reaction to a statement coming out from a former U.S. official at this point?
No, it's also an admission of a war crime is what it is. I mean, even during war, you can't deny people food. And we're not even at war with Iran, right? So, I mean, this it is a crime against humanity. It is a war crime. And there's been other quotes like that from, you know, various secretaries of state and U.S. presidents, you know, going back, well, I can remember to Chile and Allende in the 70s, where Nixon said we would make the economy scream, right? And various presidents have talked about increasing the suffering on other peoples, like in Venezuela. That the statements have been similar statements have been made about people if they want lights on and food in Venezuela, they have to get rid of their government, etc. No, this is this talk of war criminals, right? These are people who should be in The Hague at this point if you had a real justice system.
Another surprising outcome that comes from the U.S. sanctions, of which the government in a sense dismisses it, even though they do admit, is the economic cost that it comes, aside from the countries it sanctions, but for the U.S. itself. And one study had actually put that figure at around $1 billion annually, and it went back to the year, I think it was 2001. Well, if you count all the years up to now, you know, we're talking about $20 or $21 billion. I mean, that's quite a bit of money that the U.S., I'm sure, or any country can use. So the economic sanctions are not just losses for other countries that the U.S. imposes. Do you think that that's a worthy gamble the U.S. takes when you put that next to the fact that the efficiency rate is roughly about 25% at best?
Well, of course not. And it shows, again, it shows that the U.S. government even doesn't care about its own people, right? I mean, let's be honest here. The U.S. now, for example, these sanctions against Russia has created an inflationary period, is causing food prices to rise in the U.S. and food shortages. In fact, Biden at the outset of those sanctions warned there would be food shortages in the U.S. We now have a baby formula shortage in the U.S. So these sanctions are done knowing even that the American people are going to suffer. None of these things benefit any people, not in the targeted countries, not in the U.S. It just shows a total disregard for human life, whether it be foreign life or American life. And yeah, I mean, it's something that needs to be pushed back against.
And taking the vantage point from Iran, we are still obviously experiencing sanctions, but really the ones that are suffering the most, even if you want to put aside the types of hardships that people are having for their basic needs, such as food staples, are the ones that are in dire need of medical aid. That's not happening because, for starters, you have the financial system, payment system, which is locked. And even humanitarian organizations can't transfer money into Iran on humanitarian grounds. Shouldn't there be anything that could stop the U.S. from this aspect of it, so at least medical equipment or supplies or aid can come into the country?
Yeah, well, there's numerous legal instruments that require countries who are engaged in, you know, even wars on other countries to make sure the food and medicine gets in. It's called the Geneva Conventions, right? The Hague Convention of 1907. I mean, for over a century, the community of nations has recognized that countries cannot deny other countries food and medicine. Yeah, I mean, even this could be an issue for the International Criminal Court. If you had a legal system, an international legal system that was working, yes, something would be done to make sure that people in Iran were getting medicine and food. And it is it's shocking that that is not happening.
And then final question to you. The sanctions regime, one of the things that it does do is that it turns people against the U.S., the sanctioned country. And that could pose a national security threat for the U.S. Does the U.S. take that into account when it imposes sanctions, especially severe sanctions, on countries that it has applied so far?
I don't think so. I mean, the U.S. government doesn't seem to judge national security in the way most rational people do. I mean, most rational people view national security as the security of people like me and my fellow citizens. But the U.S. doesn't care about that, right? It's not about national security in that sense. It's about domination, economic, political, military domination. And to that extent, the sanctions fit into that goal perfectly, even though it compromises the real security, again, of the U.S.'s own citizens that the U.S. government seems not to care about.
All right. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Daniel Kovalik, university lecturer and author of The Plot to Attack Iran from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thank you for your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takvai, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
is back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. A very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, where we discuss the most controversial topics, the most interesting topics, wherein we have a roundtable discussion. Today also, we're going to have something like that. I'm your host, Zainab. I have with me Fatima from California and Siddiqa from the UK. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaykum assalam.
Very warm welcome to the show. And today, since we are all women standing a sting around the table, let's discuss something about the women. Well, Fatima, when we search about the women on the internet, we really don't get some pleasant stuff all the time. What do you find when you search about women on the internet?
It will be mostly about like fashion and makeup. And I mean, if it was an Iranian website, maybe it would be more like famous women here in the media or actresses, I don't know. But in the Western websites will be mostly like fashion and just showing off the woman's beauty. Usually, I think that's the way it is. I mean,
there you go. Yeah. Showing off the woman's beauty. What do you think, Siddiqa? What's your take on that?
So I search a lot.
Well,
I go on Quora, I don't go on Reddit, but I do read comments that come up on Reddit. I have searched, I go on Quora, I read comments that pop up on Reddit and everything. Unfortunately, I don't have a very positive outlook for what goes on in the world. Mm-hmm. I think women are now reduced to a very lowly materialistic life.
All right.
So I'll give you one example, right? Yesterday I bought a pair of socks, right? Does socks have a relevance to a woman's neck and her hair? Not really. But there was a nice picture of a woman with her hair and neck blasted on the cardboard paper of a sock. And I was like, what connection does socks have with a woman's neck and hair?
True.
The concept is that women just have to be advertised for everything. Mm-hmm. You want to get sales, just blast a woman's neck on it, right? Just get a woman who's either, I'm very sorry to say this, but semi-naked. Mm-hmm. Just post her on there and it'll get everyone's attention, right? One of the things that we used to have in the UK, and this used to be in the Sun newspaper. I don't think it happens anymore. For those who are in the UK, they will know. Sun newspaper, page 3. Every time there would be a picture of a woman in very gladly dressed, rather. That newspaper used to sell like hotcakes. Page 3 used to get a whole newspaper to sell. Sun newspaper used to be owned. It was, you know, I would classify it as more like gossip newspaper. Mm-hmm. And they've
all
been
the royalty
involved.
News. They always have all not the royalty news.
Not only royalty, but yeah. I'm not sure if I would be correct to classify like the equivalent of Fox News in the UK.
Yeah.
But they do have some of those traits. When I go on Quora and Reddit, you know, it's just like, I'll give you a small example of how women have lowered themselves. There was a story of a woman who, you know, a lot of these bridezilla gossips come up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these women come on and they complain. And one of the women was like, my husband's family are all deaf, so they require sign language.
All right.
And now what her husband's family wanted was that they have a sign language interpreter so they can follow through with the marriage. True. And this sparked into a massive fight between her and her husband if you can have a sign interpreter on the stage with them. I mean, it's just a sign interpreter. He's not going to come. It's not going to break your vows if you have someone to accommodate someone who can't function as you.
True.
We don't need to create everything into this huge drama just so that we can satisfy a small part of our ego. So women, unfortunately, we have lowered ourselves to this materialistic, egoistic life. My wish, my life, what I want has to go. And I really don't
and
care
so
what you want.
And so many hashtags, you know, my body, my life. It's my, like, I don't
yeah,
want to be
so it's like my body, my life.
Stuff.
My yeah. body, my life works for naturism, which is basically accepting nudity. But
true.
My body, my life doesn't work for the hijab.
True.
That time we have
yeah.
to
interfere.
We have to
think
interfere.
Of it at that time, yeah.
Yeah, at that yeah. time there is no my body, my life. But when it comes yeah. to nudity, which would please a lot of people, then my body, my life, you know, let's yeah. go wrong with the slogan.
Like yeah. in France, it's illegal now for them to be wearing hijab and they were having all those
protests. It's just ridiculous. But then their nuns, their Catholic nuns, have a hijab, which is, I think, some of them even
more strict than our hijab.
They're fine, but not the Muslim. I didn't get it. So it's just, they're just, yeah. I get,